Thank you for listening to Living on Purpose. And now we'll get back to my phone conversation with Dr. Bruce Lipton.
What is the definition of dogma?
I love this because as we're going to talk about coming up, is that let's first go this way.
Okay.
That fundamental truth in science is called in the science textbook the central dogma, the fundamental dogma. And the dogma is that the flow of information in biology, which was a belief that was seeded by Darwin, remember we said that traits control it. When they found the traits for the DNA, they created the dogma, and the dogma is DNA controls life. That DNA goes through a sequence of steps. DNA influences what is called RNA, which is like a Xerox copy of DNA. And then the RNA is used to make the proteins of the body, and the proteins give us our shapes, our physical characters, and our behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask, where did your physical shape, characters, and behaviors come from? It comes from the DNA.
Right.
And since the DNA was given God status, because what it meant, if you look at the dogma, nothing influences DNA. DNA influences other things. So the source comes from the DNA, called the central dogma. I taught this. I taught it in medical school. It's being taught right now in any elementary school that's surrounding you. It's being taught.
This is incredible.
And what's interesting about this is when I got out of the field by being a heretic, why? Because I challenged the dogma, and I realized that by staying inside that, you know, they didn't want me in there because I was like a priest that runs into the Vatican and calls the Pope a phony. I didn't really care to stay there anyway because I realized they were not paying attention. But when I got out of it, that's when I came to finally look up the word dogma, because I realized, look, I've been teaching this as fact of science, like concrete, for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, dogma is a funny name for it. So I looked up dogma, and I was shocked, because when I saw the definition of dogma, it was, this is the quote, a definition based on religious persuasion and not scientific fact. And I realized, my God, that actually it was a correct assertion about the DNA story.
Mm-hmm.
It was a religious belief because the scientific fact never backed it up.
Exactly.
But it was believed since 1859. And it was such a strong belief that the belief existed before the experiments. Even before they knew DNA existed, the belief existed. Found DNA, plugged it into the belief. But the issue was, as we started to find out, that belief is fractured. For the reason is, DNA does not control anything. And yet we bought it because it was inherent in the belief system that the traits control life, that the traits are controlled by the DNA. DNA controls life. And then it turns out, but a simple scientific assessment reveals this. This is like, we have to stop and just say, wait a minute, what is DNA? It's a linear blueprint that the DNA is cut up into segments with little blueprints, each segment representing a blueprint to make a protein of the body. It's actually a linear blueprint how to make proteins of the body, and the proteins are the building blocks. Why this is relevant is because we have given DNA its own life. You know, it's like the gene turns on. What does that connote to somebody who says, oh, I had nothing to do with it, but this gene turned on, and then I had cancer? Oh, okay, then you're a victim because the genes did this to you. And so then we go to the doctor as victims, and they try to change the chemistry for the faulty gene. That's the nature of the way it is.
Right.
But then we come back to a simple truth. Wait a minute, what was a gene? No, a gene is a blueprint to make a protein. So in this regard, then, what I give in my lectures is just a little story that people, it's like, stop and think about this. You go to an architect's office, the architect is working on a blueprint, and you stand behind the architect, and as he's working on it, you casually ask the architect, excuse me, is that blueprint on or off? And then the moment of that silliness dawns on you, I mean, the architect looks at you like, oh, what are you talking about? It's neither on and off. It's a blueprint. It has no on or off. It's a blueprint. And the reality is, a DNA gene is a blueprint. It has no on or off. It's a linear story, an assembly diagram of how to make a protein. Just like you could put it on an architect's table and actually draw out the blueprint. So I have this gene blueprint now on the table of the architect, and then I say, is that gene on or off? And then, of course, you have to look at, well, there's no on and off. It's a blueprint. And yet, what is the central dogma tell us about biology? It says DNA controls. That means activity. Like, the DNA makes a decision. Like DNA or genes are self-actualizing, that they decide things. And all of a sudden, we become victims of their decisions. And the reality is, a blueprint doesn't decide anything. So the new field of biology that is actually officially, I think, formalized maybe 16 years ago, which is interesting because it's still trying to break itself out of the box that the conventional scientists don't want to look at, is this new field is called epigenetic control. And this differs from what we teach in medical school, which is called genetic control.
So what is epigenetic control?
Let's first go back to genetic control. If I say literally, what does genetic control mean? It's a control by genes.
Right.
That's our belief system. That's what we teach. Your life is not anything to do with you. It's controlled by genes, genetic control. The new science is called epigenetic control. The prefix epi is Latin for above.
Uh-huh.
So like if I say the word epidermis,
mm-hmm.
that means the layer above the dermis. Well, if I now go back literally and say epigenetic control, what does it literally mean? It says control above the genes. And this is the revolutionary new science, because it turns out, so what is it that controls those genes? When we have been victims of genes, now we're finding out, no, it's not the genes that have caused the problem, it's the control of the genes. And
right.
I say, now what is that? And the answer is this: epigenetic control reveals that biological organisms interact with their environment. And whatever information is provided by the environment, that information is translated by the biology into a behavior of the biology so that it can adjust the biology to stay alive
mm-hmm.
in that ever-changing environment. For example, what controls, let's say, your body temperature? And well, you could go in there and give me a whole physiological thing and go back and say, oh, there's a portion in the brain and it senses and that is the control. And the fact is, no. That is the mechanism of the control. What is the control is the temperature. Walk outside.
The environment.
It's right. If you walk outside and it's cold, then the signal of cold is picked up by the biology,
mm-hmm.
converted into a behavioral response that causes your body temperature to warm up.
Mm-hmm.
But if you walk outside and it's warm out, the sensing of warm activates a different pathway, changes the biochemistry, and now you perspire and cool down.
Right.
So the issue was this: I can give you all the brain control mechanisms, what they call the centers of the brain that control temperature.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say the centers control temperature, it's like, well, they manifest the mechanism of the control. Do they control it? No. What the temperature does is controlled by the prevailing temperature of the environment. And why that's relevant is because, well, if I want to change my temperature in my body, well, there's two ways to do it. I can go outside and feel a different environment,
mm-hmm.
Or change the temperature in my house, raise it up or down, and then I can adjust my biology. Or we can do the conventional medical pharmaceutical idea is, you need a control mechanism. I can give you a drug that I can change your temperature. And one of them is like, well, one is a natural control, and the other one is an interference with a machine.
Yeah. I'm going to just take a little bit of a leap here, Bruce. This is like an ongoing thing for people who've been adopted and don't know their birth parent traits are, right? Like
yeah.
whether they have a propensity to get cancer or breast cancer or heart attack or stroke. And are you saying that none of that is relevant now in our belief system?
If you change your belief system, you see, here's an interesting phrase.
Okay.
This is like a stock phrase. It's a very profoundly important phrase, so listen to it carefully. It comes from Henry Ford, the founder of the Ford Motor Company. And this is a truth, and it's so beautiful if you understand it. It goes like this: if you think you can, or you think you can't, you're right.
Exactly.
And basically what it says is this: whether you can or can't is really based on your belief if you can or can't.
Yes.
And if you change your belief to I can, then you can. And if you have a belief that you can't, then you can't. And why is this relevant? Because your ability was in your belief, not in your mechanical ability. It was in your belief.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, whatever you believe is going to become material. Now, here's what the point is. I go into a doctor. I get the belief that I am a victim of genetic heredity, that cancer runs in my family.
Mm-hmm.
That my belief, as acquired from the doctor, is that I have the greatest propensity in my life to manifest as cancer because it's genetic, it's in my family.
Yeah.
I walk away from that doctor, what is my belief? I am a potential victim waiting for what? The cancer gene to act.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's my belief system. And why is this important? Because if I actually believe that, and we understand now the epigenetic control that we talked about, the environmental interpretation, is filtered by the brain. So if the brain perceives the environment and then makes a statement about or belief about that environment, that statement, that belief, is converted into biology.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we're in a warm room, comfortable room, and I hypnotize you. I give you a hypnotic suggestion that it's extremely hot in this room, even if it's not. But your perception now, because it's got a distorted belief, because that's what the hypnosis is, right? I
mm-hmm.
distort the belief. I say it's hot. Your perception is now not reading the real temperature. It's buying what the mind said, because the mind is the interface between the outside temperature and the inside temperature. The mind says, no, it's really, really hot in here, because that's what it believes. The cells of the body, their information comes from the mind. The mind said hot. So the body is going to start to perspire like crazy. And guess what? Temperature out there wasn't hot at all.
Mm-hmm.
I love this one. This is another interesting one, because it's like just to see how the brain and the body coordinate so that if the brain buys a belief, the body will manifest that belief.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I hypnotize you and then tell you that this glass of water on the table weighs 1,000,000 pounds. And I ask you to lift it. Now, the whole idea is this. Of course, in any logical sense of the term, of course, it's just a glass of water. I lift it, no problem at all. But if I put in the belief that I believe that glass is 1,000,000 pounds, and I'm hypnotized, when I put my hand around that glass and try to lift it up, you will see me strain, and I could strain so hard, I could challenge my heart that I could probably get a heart attack trying to lift up a glass of water. And you say, well, how can that be? I mean, the glass only weighs that little bit of water. And here's what happens. Because the mind made it 1,000,000 pounds, which means you can't lift it up. That's your belief. I can't lift 1,000,000 pounds. Then the nervous system has already got a program. It says, in regard to this glass of water, you cannot lift it. That's the program. That's the command. Why? It's 1,000,000 pounds. Of course you can't lift it.
Mm-hmm.
I put my hands around it. As the muscles could feel that I could actually lift it, then what would it say, a feedback from my body to my mind? If my mind says it's 1,000,000 pounds, I put my hand around it and I lift it, and it says, oh, you've lifted 1,000,000 pounds. Okay? Well, the mind says, no, you can't lift 1,000,000 pounds. You know, here's the funny part.
Jeez.
The muscles that are going to be lifting up the glass become counteracted upon by the muscles that would be putting down the glass.
Hmm.
And so it becomes an isometric exercise. The muscles of lifting are countered by the muscles of putting down.
Wow.
And what's the result? You are struggling, your muscles are feverishly working, but in opposite directions to each other, and guess what? Can't lift the glass.
Interesting.
And now your mind is satisfied. I knew it's 1,000,000 pounds because I couldn't lift it, because if you lift it, it would be a distortion to the mind of, you can't lift 1,000,000 pounds, how did you do that? Here, I love this one. This is a reverse one. So exciting. It was just a recent article in the paper about it, and I got to get the reference because we talk about it, but it came back up again. There was an Oldsmobile that had turned over, and a child was caught under the car, and a woman came out. Of course, she could have gone back in the house and called 911, and there's a baby under the car. No thinking. The mission was, I have to get the baby out from the car. The woman lifted the car and pulled the baby out. It was so exciting because here's what the story goes on.
Yeah.
Then when the police got there and everything, they asked her to recount, so what happened? And she said, well, I came out and the baby was under the car and I got all nervous and everything. I had to get the baby. And then she said in her own conscious mind, I lifted the car. And then she passed out.
Wow.
She passed out because the mind couldn't even buy that was a reality, that it was such a conflict.
Yeah.
That she actually, when being asked about it, the mind caused her to pass out because it didn't make any sense anymore. And why is it relevant is that, what powers do we have? Well, we're virtually unlimited in powers except for the powers of belief. And if I believe I can't lift the car, I can't lift the car.
Yeah.
You can't heal myself because the professional told me, then even if I have the ability, I will cancel my own healing ability.
It's like when people are going in for chemotherapy and they kind of get, you know, 1 foot over in that camp and then they put another foot over in the complementary treatment camp and they can't really make a commitment either way. I mean, it kind of divides their belief then, doesn't it? It probably dilutes it.
They have no true belief now that they can follow. And
yeah.
Between beliefs, because one belief challenges the other.
Yeah, like the muscles you were just talking about.
That was actually a wonderful, and I was thinking the same thing as you said that. Because when they challenge each other, yeah. They go no place in the middle. That's a big problem.
And there's this quote, I think it's from Jonathan Livingston Seagull, argue for your limitations and sure enough they're yours.
From my point of view, coming from the conventional world of teaching and being a practitioner in the scientific research of a belief system that claimed genetic dominance and mechanism over anything else, to come to where I am now with a new biology and the new physics,
mm-hmm.
and then reflect back on, my God, people have been saying the same story from the beginning. And it's interesting because I wasn't raised in the Christian tradition, but everything that Jesus said and everything he did was based on the belief of the people he worked with. So we helped somebody get healed. He didn't say, I'm going to heal you. He asked the first question before he would even work with them. He said, do you believe you can be healed? And then you are healed by your faith.
Yeah.
What was the point? Was that it was the belief. He didn't say, I'm healing you. He actually owned what he knew was true. You were healed by your own faith. And then he said, all those things you see me do, you can do them better than I can. But for what reason? Why can't you do them? Because you don't believe.
Yeah.
And now the power of belief. Now this is like, and it's fun because this is from the spiritual tradition, but it will make sense to this very minute. And it goes like this. I paraphrase this, not being a Bible scholar or anything like that. And my paraphrase is this. Jesus could not do miracles in his own hometown. He had to leave town.
Right.
And the reason is what? Because he just lost it, like kryptonite, that now the miracles don't work? It was, in a sense, a kryptonite. What it was the belief of other people.
Yeah.
Because he said, everything I do is because of the belief of you. If the other people didn't believe, then he had no power to do a miracle. And they looked at him as like, oh, that's Joe's kid. What the hell is he? But when Joe's kid left somewhere else, he was the Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, that had a different meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And other people had this belief, and so when he came in, then encouraged collective belief to create miracles, and miracles were created. If he would go back home, the collective disbelief of the people around him even prevented him from expressing the miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, stop that long enough and think about it this way. I am a person in a community. The community's belief is conventional medicine. The community's belief is that in order to heal, I need to take these drugs or have this surgical procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to myself, but I can overcome this, I can override this. I'm going to do my own miracle. If you heal yourself in the presence of an entire community that says you can't, that would be such a distortion that it's interesting because in the same thing that Jesus couldn't do the miracle because the people didn't believe, if you are trying to create the miracle in your healing, but you're in a community that has total disbelief about that, then you will end up in the same situation that Jesus was, and that was, I'm sorry, I can't do the miracle because nobody else is here supporting it.
Now, this links into my understanding of what you're talking about, the body being like a community and the subconscious being that disbelieving community. Would that be accurate?
Well, the subconscious is the collective beliefs by which the community adheres. So, meaning this, basically as the book talked about, is that each one of us, although we represent ourselves as a single human body, that singularity is not a real truth because the body itself is made out of up to like 50 trillion cells. It's the cells that are the units of life. The cells, we are a community of cells. And why is this important is because I didn't say we're a bunch of cells, we're a community of cells.
Right.
Cells used to live alone. Matter of fact, for the first 3 billion years on this planet, there were only single-celled organisms. They didn't join up and form physical communities. They were just single organisms. Well, when they joined up and started to assemble into colonies, and the colonies got bigger, and then they took on the shape of animals and plants, when they joined these colonies, there had to be an agreement. And the agreement is this. Well, every cell is intelligent. If you join a community, you're joining to share a common vision. And therefore, if you're inside a community, then you have to agree to what's going on in the community, because if you don't, then the community falls apart. So the nature is this. While every cell is intelligent, when it joins the community, it will defer its own personal intelligence and accept the intelligence or the information sent from the top down, the central voice,
mm-hmm.
that I call it, the spokes for the community,
right,
which is represented by the mind, which is connected in a sense to the brain, but not the brain, but connected to the brain. The design of the system was to organize the community and have the brain be the integrator of all the functions.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain passes down information from the top of how to integrate everybody to cooperate in this thing. So the brain's perceptions of what's going on by the nature of the community override the perceptions of the individual cells, so that an individual cell in your body may say, well, everything is wonderful and healthy and fine. I don't see anything wrong. And the brain sends down a signal that says,
right.
No, we're under attack. We're under threat. And all of a sudden, the individual cell doesn't see any reason to it. Guess what? The mechanism from the top said, get into protection. Then the cell adjusts its biology to fit the protection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem, of course, is this. Down at the cellular level, I got this communication that I need protection. If the cell was really thinking, it might say, you know, is this really true, or is my government screwed up? And the reality is, because sometimes there are misinterpretations about life.
Sure.
And if there's a misinterpretation, the cells don't have a choice to say, oh, I don't believe that. The cells are part of the community. They have to do what this community says. So I'll give you an example. As I said, when we go out and touch the temperature, the perception of temperature, the signals of the environment, control our own internal responses, okay? Well, think if there's a distortion of that, of the perception. So I use the case of an anorexic, that we look at this anorexic and we see this person skinny as a rail, near death, you know. It's like, oh my God, I feel very scared. This person's got no meat on them, you know.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, so we look at the person, we see this total skinny little person, but when that person looks at the mirror of themselves, they perceive a much more bloated individual.
And how can that be?
Because there's a distortion. It's almost just like there's a visual distortion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The visual distortion comes from a belief system that was acquired very early in life.
And is that the subconscious then?
That would be the subconscious.
Okay.
It learned something about its own perception of maybe I'm too big. And some connections now in psychology have connected, in fact, the number of people that are anorexic, when they were in utero in development, there were challenges to the mother and her health. And so the system was, in a sense, trying to eliminate weight to support the mother.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a concept of, no, you have
yeah.
too much,
mm-hmm.
and you shouldn't have that much. And so when they get older, their mind will look at the world and say, you know, you have too much, you shouldn't have that much. So when it looks at the self in the mirror, it's like, well, it's too much. And so there's a distorted image, but what's the point? Well, the cells in the inside, they don't get to look at the real mirror. They get to look at the interpretation of the mirror through what the mind said.
Mm-hmm.
So if the mind said too fat, the cells don't look around at each other and say, Jesus, it's already thinned out here so much, you know. But the information comes down, says too fat, and so the system will try to eliminate more.
Yeah.
And the point is, well, how much do you eliminate? Until you're the right weight, but if the system is distorted, then you could kill yourself before you get to the right weight.
Mm-hmm.
Perceptions control biology, but sometimes our perceptions are skewed or inaccurate or basically misperceptions. Regardless of whether it's true in the real sense or believed to be true, but it's a misperception, the cells respond to whatever the signal is that came out of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So the cells don't see whether it's true or not. They just respond to the signal. So if the brain has a distorted perception, the biology has a distorted biology.
So this puts a lot of responsibility on our thoughts, right? And on ourselves, rather than feeling, as you were saying earlier on, as being victims of that biology. We actually can shape that through how we look at things. And that's not only how we look at things, but being conscious of how we look at things.
Well, exactly, because that was the whole issue. I mean, why is it that a person that is riddled with cancer and everybody
mm-hmm.
counting this person out as dead has a change of belief? And says, I'm getting out of this place. I don't
mm-hmm.
really care. I'm not putting up with this. They pull the wires, the plugs, whatever they do, they get out. And all of a sudden, they realize they don't have the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That's called a spontaneous remission.
Well, it's also called a miracle and an exception.
Well, yeah, but that's the problem, because it doesn't fit to any of the mechanical initiatives and directives that have been programmed by the medical people. So if it's outside of the box, they cannot entertain anything other than the information that's inside the box. And inside the box is, this is a biochemical machine controlled by genes. If it was already got cancer, that's a distortion of the machine. It should die. And yet, when some kind of healing occurs, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, we made a misdiagnosis. That's our usual thing, because what
yeah, right.
claim, and this is the hardest thing, what if I claimed I healed myself? Stop and think about that for a second. You have here the biggest industry on the planet today, the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, for sure.
And their money controls the advertising, the media, what you see on the television, the news.
Yeah.
So their belief systems shape what we perceive, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is this, what if people stepped outside the box all of a sudden and said, I seem to have gotten a lot better without getting medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, the people inside the box are going to get very nervous.
Yeah.
And the first thing they're going to claim is, well, that person outside the box is stupid, and they could kill you if you followed them. Don't go there, you know, because the threats are that if you follow them, that is not scientific, because we are scientific. They're outside the box. And therefore, you want to be scientific, then you stay with us. You go outside, and you're in, you know, snake oil land. And the only problem with it is this, is that over time, the threats of staying in the box become more severe than the threats of going outside the box.
Seems to me you've been outside the box for quite a while.
Well, I left essentially the first time in 1980, came back into academia in 1987 after 7 years of devoting into a new understanding, came back and had an opportunity to experiment with these new understandings at Stanford University School of Medicine, published my papers, and then left again in 92 because revealing what I saw the first time in 1980 even with more clarity, and yet the field was so involved in the Human Genome Project that because my results were really looking outside of the box and finding that the genes did not control things, the interior people looked at me like, get out of here, you know, we're the human genome people, and you're trying to say that genes are not that powerful. I didn't fit. I left again because their science eyes were not open. They were closed by dogma.
Yeah.
And that meant then the nature of what I perceived as science really now was religion. In this, here I offer scientific experiments that are actually published, try to discuss it to them. It appears to be an exception to their way of thinking. And since they're already on a mission for genes, then let's don't go there. And I'm thinking, well, you're not really scientific because if there's an exception, there are no exceptions. I mean, if you have a law, if it's a scientific truth, I have a truth with these exceptions.
Yeah, right.
Well, then you don't have a truth.
No.
Because if the exceptions, that means then your truth doesn't count for everything. So exceptions become an anathema. And for me, they never were, because as a research scientist, I really looked at it the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
The exceptions revealed that I didn't understand something, and that by addressing the exceptions, I can enhance my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, science had changed, unfortunately, in the last number of years, and I saw it very, very much. The simplest insight to that is when I first was a graduate student, let's say University of Virginia, and then when I was an initial faculty member, University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, I could tell you when I walked through the faculty parking lot, you saw old beat-up Chevys and Volkswagens and you know, run-down vehicles and things like that, because we were scientists, man. We didn't make any money, but we were out there for the, you know, the pioneer venture. When I left the industry, and I was at Stanford then, and walked out in the parking lot, and walked among all the Beamers and Mercedes and the sports cars and all the money, I realized, this thing has changed. People are into biology now not because of the reason I went into it 30, 40 years ago, which was, the adventure of a new frontier, Star Trek, you know, going where no other people have gone.
You were gripped by the fascination of it.
And today, people get in the field because that's where the money is. But
yeah.
That just really reveals, well, what was the purpose of coming into science?
Hmm.
And if the purpose is coming in to make money, then you go on the money track and you don't focus on the things that don't make money.
Well, it sounds like you're making a new school for yourself with your new book here, Biology of Belief, and going around and sharing this. You're doing a lot of talks and presentations these days, it sounds like, eh?
Well, that's because the Reformation has begun.
Exactly. That's
because,
it.
You know, people are beginning to say, there's got to be another way because this is not working the way they
Perfect.
Said it was.
So you're a forerunner in the first place, and now
I'm
you're...
among many. So, you know, the beautiful part about it is that when I first started, I was apparently to myself very much isolated, going, I'm the crazy heretic, burn me at the stake.
The mad scientist.
And yet time has been very good to me, and everything I found back in those years as preliminary pioneering science is now becoming more or less mainstream science.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, you're one of many voices now, and I like your portrayal of it as a Reformation. I think that's totally accurate in what's happening these days.